Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, American Warrior Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Stick around. I know you're going to enjoy this show. September 11th changed our nation forever. We've had 9/11 survivors on American Warrior before. I'm thinking in particular Dan Rowan, a New York City firefighter who lost most of his crew on that fateful day. We've also had many military guests who mentioned that 9/11 was what inspired them to join the military, and we've even had people on duty recalling of where they were when they first heard the news. But to be honest, I'd never given much thought to those members of our military that were in the midst of things on that day, that were involved directly in the actions on that day. We're so fortunate this morning to have a gentleman joining us. I heard him address the Distinguished Flying Cross Society recently. I was transfixed by his presentation and knew we had to have him share his story with American Warrior Radio listeners. So we're very grateful to have joining us in the studio this morning, this afternoon, Lieutenant General Thomas Keck, U.S. Air Force retired. Tom, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here, and I really think your mission of Warrior Radio is important, especially getting the active duty, guard, reserve components all telling their story, because they're under a lot of stress today. Veterans are under stress today. The world is under stress today, but this is a great platform to speak from, and I'm happy to be here.
You know, it's interesting, Tom, you mentioned that. I was at a retirement ceremony for a PJ at DM a couple weeks ago, and a three-star general conducted that ceremony, and he was talking about the pace of deployment, particularly for specialists like the PJs, and he said, look, we're looking at 10, 11, 12, 14, 15 deployments. DOD's never been in this place before. We're not even sure how to address it. So,
well, the system is definitely stressed, and the troops are stressed, but they're as dedicated as can be, and I'm just proud to be associated with those guys serving today.
Well, now, Tom, let's talk about your story. You're the guy in studio today. We want to talk about you. You began your pilot training at Williams Air Force Base back in 1969. I wasn't in the country yet. I just want to share that.
Williams was one of the finer pilot training bases in Chandler, Arizona, and unfortunately encroachment got it closed, but everybody who went through Willie knows the stories and knows their training and appreciates being in Arizona.
Now, I tell you, Tom, looking at your resume, I mean, if it had wings, you flew it. 4,600 flight hours, 886 in combat, everything from A-10s to B-2 bombers, and even something called the SR-71 Blackbird. We don't have enough time to cover all of them, but I tell you, the Blackbird stories are some of the coolest. You literally are someone that has flown faster than a speeding bullet.
Well, actually, that's a correct statement if you do all the science behind it, but it is one of the highlights of my career, and flying the Blackbird at 80,000 feet plus and around 85,000 feet plus, 15 miles high, going 2,200 miles per hour, Mach 3 plus, Mach 3.2. Every time we flew, we went to speed and altitude. The sky is a dark, dark blue up there at altitude, and you can just barely see curvature of the Earth. But you're clicking off every 2 seconds, 35 miles a minute, every 2 seconds a mile goes by. And it's about like looking out an airliner window and looking at the ground. It's not a blurring sensation of speed, but the ground's moving about 5 times faster.
Now, at that altitude, you can see curvature, or?
You can, and there's what we call the bad wing, a little sunblock, because it's very bright, no weather up there, no pollution, and it's just something that no one ever forgets.
What led you to Blackbirds? Again, I'm not kidding. Folks, look up his resume online. I mean, you've flown just about everything. How on earth did you get into the Blackbird?
It's a volunteer program. I was flying B-52s in Vietnam back when we had the three-ship cells and did a lot of, we call them dumb bombs at the time, but there's a statement to be made with large numbers of weapons. I applied. I was interested in it. I knew some people who were in the program. I was so excited about it, I applied. And you have to go out and interview, fly the T-38 a couple of times, fly the simulator and see how you adapt. And if you compete well with the other group that's competing at the same time, you get selected.
How many, when you were flying the Blackbird, how many Blackbird pilots were there in the country, give or take? It's a pretty small group, I'm guessing.
Small group. Over 300 people have flown the plane, but only 86 pilots have flown operational missions in the aircraft. It was a surveillance. Actually, it was supposed to be announced by President Johnson as the RS-71. He made a mistake in the speech, and it became SR-71. But the history of it is goes back to Lockheed Skunk Works, and it was developed by Kelly Johnson and Ben Rich, his lead engineer. He was 30 years ahead of his time. When you say speed, the problem is heat, and 500 to 1200 degrees Fahrenheit. And then what Kelly Johnson did was he had loose, we call it a loose state, on the ground, and the aircraft would leak JP-7 fuel on the ground. But at speed and altitude, it would get hot, expand, and be sealed tight for that part of the flight. And there's some high-speed solutions that Kelly Johnson came up with that they're still using today. And it was the first stealth stage or version of an aircraft because of the thin chines and the fact that the rudder tails were tilted inward. There were no right angles on the aircraft.
Folks, if you'd like to see an SR-71, we are doing a live remote broadcast from Pima Air and Space Museum next week, beginning at noon. You can go out there and see the plane, not the plane, but probably a plane, similar to what General Keck flew. General, we've got about 2 minutes real quick. You're moving at three times the speed of sound?
That's true. I passed... flew a Barents Sea mission out of Mildenhall in England once, and we refueled, and we passed London on the way back home to California, and it was a four-hour flight from London to California, and when we landed, we were landing before we took off, so I was out of sleep sequence for a couple of days.
I'm not the brightest guy in the studio. You landed before you took off?
Easily. You could make the sun come up in the west with an SR-71.
How cool is that? The other thing, too, you're flying at that speed, at that altitude. Do those aircraft have ejection seats? And probably not one you ever want to use that, huh?
Something you never want to use, but at speed and altitude, the pressure suit protects you if you lost cabin pressure. And if you did have to eject, you could the seat would inflate. You had spurs on to retract your ankles back. And there's a D-ring between your legs that you cross your arms and pull the D-ring. And if you had to go... We all had confidence in the Physiological Support Division that they would take care of us, and they actually had that happen a couple of times, and people did survive.
And most of your missions, I'm guessing you're flying over places that we're not supposed to be, so you don't always want to... It's not just getting out of the aircraft, it's the landing, too.
Exactly right, and there's a lot of places you don't want to land because they know you've been watching them.
Great stories. Ladies and gentlemen, we're joined live in studio by Lieutenant General Thomas Keck, U.S. Air Force retired. Give us a call, 751-1041, if you'd like. When we come back, part of the reason I really wanted General Keck here was to talk about his experiences on 9/11. You're not going to want to miss this, folks. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior, folks. We're joined live in studio by Lieutenant General Thomas Keck. You heard him talk about, man, if they had wings, he's flown it. Everything from A-10s to B-2 bombers, and we're talking a little bit about his experiences flying the SR-71 Blackbird, one of my favorite aircraft of all time. He literally landed before he took off, flying against the sun on a mission coming out of London. Now, what I'd like to talk about now, General, is September 11th. I mentioned at the top of the show that changed a lot of things in our country for good, but at that point in time, on September 11, 2001, you were the commander of the 8th Air Force at Barksdale Air Force Base. And just so folks, so you understand, Lieutenant General has three stars on his shoulder. Now, Tom, you were conducting an exercise that day, Global Guardian. That's how your day started. Tell us a little bit about Global Guardian and what was going on at Barksdale that morning.
Exactly right, Ben. I'd like to start with a couple of caveats first before I get into this. First of all, this is not a political discussion. This is more just my experiences, and I'd like to relate them and my impressions. Second, there's some humorous things that happen looking back, but there was absolutely nothing humorous about that day and that point in time for the history of the United States and around the world. So with that, we were in a Global Guardian exercise. We had about 2 weeks preparation time, and then a Global Guardian, it's done annually. The submarines crank up their participation, and the missiles go to 100% alert, and the bombers and the tankers all refuel, and the crews go on alert. And that morning, 9/11, we were supposed to get a message that would come in at 8 o'clock, which would be 9 o'clock East Coast time, and it would tell the crews to report to aircraft, start engines, and report in the green. We were down in the command center. Sure enough, the message came in. It was translated, decoded, and message said report to aircraft. And we were watching that, and I felt a tap on my left shoulder. And it was a captain controller, and I'll never forget, he had a yellow telephone pad, if you remember back then, those phone pads. And he said, and he handed me a note, and he said, "Sir, we just had an aircraft at the World Trade Center." Now, I said, "Captain, when you make an exercise inject, make sure you preface it with this is an input, that, in fact, you don't want to confuse people with the real world." And he said, "No, sir." And he pointed up to one of the TV monitors with CNN on and said, and just pointed, he didn't say a thing. And I saw the smoke coming from the tower. And like you and like everybody else, everybody knows where they were on 9/11, who they were with, what they were doing. And it will resonate, the stories resonate with, I'm sure, all your listeners.
Now, when he first handed you that note, you thought it was a scenario injection, or you thought that was just a surprise scenario they're throwing into the exercise?
I thought it was an exercise input, and when I first looked at the tower smoking, like you, you wondered someone must have fallen asleep or committed suicide, but I pictured a small aircraft as doing that because it didn't look like much smoke coming out of the tower. The rest is history. The second one hit. Fortunately for us, all the battle staffs were up from the Global Guardian exercise.
Right.
So we had instant communications. And I'll make this statement a couple times today. There was so much confusion that day. There's a movie called Flight 93 that really does a good job depicting the confusion of what was actually happening. But we had the communications. And within minutes, people were talking, and there was a call that came in about 15 minutes that said, "There's an aircraft inbound. They want 150,000 pounds of gas, 70 box lunches, 25 pounds of bananas, and 40 gallons of juice and coffee, and it's a code Alpha."
Now, before you get to that, Tom, so you thought the message was an exercise. You look at the TV. You see clearly that a plane had hit the World Trade Center. And then how long was it, I mean, when you see the second plane hit the towers, like the rest of us, you say, okay, this is no longer an accident. How long did it take, or at what point do you shut down the exercise and basically tell folks to lock it down where this is for real, folks, and you start to prepare your airmen?
In the exercise, you do a practice threat con delta, but it was instantly realistic, or people knew exactly what was going on. So we did say lock it down and go to an actual threat con delta, which locks the gates of the base and does a lot of other things.
Now, 8th Air Force at that time, would that have been the equivalent of Global Strike Now? So it was all the heavy bombers and the nuclear?
They were the bomber component for STRATCOM, U.S. Strategic Command in Omaha, Nebraska.
Okay, and you call, is it threat con delta?
Delta.
Under Delta, then, I'm guessing what's going through your mind is, okay, people are flying commercial planes into targets in the U.S. You're at the B-52 base. You might be a target. But, Tom, what I read is the only thing you had to send up to protect against incoming aircraft were a couple of A-10s. At that point in time, was that accurate?
That is accurate. I called Brigadier General Jack Ely, who was the reserve A-10 wing commander. He also had some B-52s. And I said, I didn't explain the question. I just said, "Jack, what can you give me?" And he said, "A-10s, cockpit alert, end of the runway." I said, "Do it."
Now, A-10s are not designed necessarily for air-to-air combat, but I'm guessing that if that Gatling gun hits something, that would take care of business.
It was something to protect the base. And I later, got a call from NORAD, and they said, "General Keck, we understand you put some aircraft on alert. You can't really do that." And I said, he said, "What kind of rationale were you using? What kind of rules of engagement?" And I said, "Common sense." And he got kind of quiet. So.
Well, Well, I guess at that point, you've got a lot of responsibility on your shoulders as a three-star general. But at that point, ThreatCon Delta, we still have airlines, planes in the air at that point in time. You had to potentially face the difficult decision of shooting down something else headed your way if you didn't know what it was.
That was probably would have all happened in seconds.
Okay.
There wasn't a lot of time for decisions, and there were some airliners that they had that discussion. Fortunately, they didn't have to do that.
Well, and the reason I wanted to preface for our listeners with all this, because pretty soon you do have a very large incoming aircraft. I think you said Code Alpha.
Code Alpha.
What the heck is a Code Alpha?
That's exactly what we said. They came back and said big. Interestingly, we figured it out what it was. The Air Force One was in the flare, and they called again and said, do not acknowledge the presidents at Barksdale. And I said, okay. And I looked at CNN, and across the bottom of the screen it said Barksdale Air Force Base. So I said, okay, I won't tell anybody.
Now, I get the – so they're asking for fuel. They're asking for box lunches. I get all that. But what's with the 25 pounds of bananas? Did you ever get an answer to that?
Probably had to do with lunch. I'm convinced his press secretary called him and said, you've got to stop and tell America they're going to be all right. He scrambled out of Sarasota, and it just made sense. They knew there was good security at Barksdale, and they knew they could get an outlet of going. He had a lot of news media with him with satellite dishes in their briefcases, and he had four congressmen with him, which he left with us as he departed. But he moved on from Barksdale into Omaha, Nebraska, to Underground Command Center.
Now, is my research, Tom, was that that was kind of the plan. Let's get him someplace as safe as possible. And he was headed towards the Midwest, but he or someone made that decision, no, I need to get on the ground as soon as possible to address the American public.
Today you can do a news conference live from Air Force One or Airborne. It's called Boeing Wideband. But back then we could not do that. And as it turned out, being on the ground saying, America, you're going to be all right, is better than saying, I'm up here safe.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree. That was definitely the right decision. Now, you've got, what, 20 minutes before the President of the United States lands at your Air Force base and on ThreatCon Delta. That's good or bad?
Well, the good news was we didn't have to coordinate with the Secret Service or paint the grass green or do anything special. But you think to yourself, should I have shined my boots a little better or shaven a little better that morning because the president's coming? But there's really no time to even think about any of that at that time.
Now, Tom, you shared a photo with me of you walking with President Bush at Barksdale that day. You're carrying a sidearm. It's not very often one sees a three-star general armed.
I had an executive officer at the time named Paul Tibbetts. He's the grandson of Brigadier General Tibbetts. And by the way, Paul Tibbetts just made two-star selection. But he brought out the book. He'd always bring out the book, and then he'd apply judgment to that. But he said, here, sir, you're supposed to arm up in ThreatCon Delta. And I said, really? And he went and got it for me, and I armed up.
What we've got, probably about 2 minutes, Tom. But so the things are, you mentioned yourself, very confusing. Now the president's on your base trying to decide what to do. I mean, at that, he's your commander-in-chief. You're the 8th Air Force commander. At that point, you've got a lot of moving parts. What can you just describe for us what, from the time the plane lands to getting him, I mean, you still have to get him someplace safe on the base, I'm guessing, or?
Sure. I've learned a couple of leadership lessons from the day, and one of the first things he said getting off Air Force One was, he could have said a lot of things that probably would have driven people into some panic, but he said, I guess I put you on the map. I said, yes, sir, you did. Welcome to Barksdale Air Force Base. And he said, I need to make a secure call to the Vice President, the Secretary of Defense, and Governor Pataki. And with that, I said, come with me, sir, to my office. And fortunately, we had White House communications who could place all those calls for him.
And Governor Pataki was the governor of New York at the time, correct?
Correct. Okay. And Karl Rove and Andrew Card were with him. We got to my office, sat down, and he initially started working, looking at some words that were written for him. It looked like it was burned off an old-time printer, and was discussing things, and he added, I used the word resolve twice, should I say, resolved twice, and everybody knew he was there for the press conference.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no one else was saying anything, so I said, Mr. President, I think America thinks resolve, strong resolve is an important thing, and reinforcement is probably a good idea. And he shrugged his shoulders and said, okay. So then I started thinking, holy smoke, now I'm a speechwriter.
So not only did he put you on the map, you can now add speechwriter to your resume.
Well, I'm not even sure he said resolve twice. So.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we're joined live in studio by Lieutenant General Tom Keck. He's talking about his experiences on September 11th. Stick around. Great show. Hey, check us out, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. All the podcasts available there. Also, like us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back. Give us a call if you'd like, 751-1041.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live in studio by Lieutenant General Thomas Keck, United States Air Force, retired. General, you are definitely an important guy. I knew that, but you still travel with your security detail. She's over there in the corner keeping a good eye on us, huh?
She protects me.
She keeps you straight, probably is a better phrase for that. Welcome to the studio, Mrs. Lieutenant General Thomas Keck. Tom, we're talking about your experiences on 9/11. You've got the president there at your base, Barksdale Air Force Base. I assume you gave him some advice on his speech. He made the speech, which all of us who were, you know, of an age will remember that speech. And life went on. What other sorts of things? I mean, how long was he at Barksdale before he moved on to Nebraska?
He was actually on the ground about an hour and 53 minutes before he went down to the 8th Air Force Conference Room to make his press release. He sat at my desk, and all I wanted was one picture of him sitting at my desk because my girls' soccer pictures were behind him, but. This was not a happy visit or a take pictures or a handshaking visit. This was a serious, dead serious visit. But he sat there, and Andrew Carr and Karl Rove were busy, so he looked at me and he said, you know, America's going to watch me and decide whether my voice cracked or I was perspiring or I looked nervous. And I took that as he was psyching himself up to go on world platform and talk about what just happened, the tragedy that just happened to America. And he went down and he made the release. He did fine. The better delivery he made was a week later, the joint session of Congress, where he allegedly took the speech from the speechwriters and sent them all home, and he narrated it, changed it, edited it himself. And that was him talking. He made the press release, and I'm sure most, like you said, most people were glued to the television when they did it. He came back up to my office, and for the first time, he saw the towers coming down on the news. And again, everybody else was busy. He turned to me, and he said, this is a verbatim statement. Nobody said, Karen Hughes didn't say, Mr. President, say this. He looked me in the eye, and he says, I don't know who this is, but we're going to find out, and we're going to go after them. And we're not just going to slap them on the wrist. We're going after them. Now, that was all President Bush, and he followed through on all those statements.
You're a leader. You've achieved one of the highest commands possible in the United States military, so you're a good judge of character. Did you get a sense? He never struck me as someone who was prone to fits of pique. He seemed, I mean, you know, considering the situation, what was going on, he seemed pretty focused on the mission at hand, whatever that might be.
Well, he was, someone wrote a letter to the New York Times and said that he should have gone back to Washington, and it was, everything was unfortunate, but I wrote to the Times, and interestingly, they published it, but I said, President was in command, he was in control, and we were lucky to have had him as our commander-in-chief that day, and that, those are true words.
Now, what happened? So he takes off, goes on about. What was the rest of your day or week or a couple of weeks like? I mean, what sorts of things did you have to do to... Because, I mean, it was a while before we figured out what was going on, and there's not really any place to send the B-52s at that point, I'm guessing.
Well, we finished the conference, and we went back downstairs, and God love the security forces, they brought a Humvee with a 50 cal on top for him to ride in. And he just said, no, I think I'm going to take that vehicle. And he pointed to a white minivan, which was the supervisor of flying's vehicle that had a bunch of radios in it, and he's in charge of the flight line and last chance checks and making sure everything on the airfield's working right. The call sign was Soccer Mom. We later changed it to Air Force One. But he said, he hopped in and he said, come on, let's go. And as we drove out, the crews were in the aircraft, and we left the crews in the aircraft in case we had to scramble to launch them. He saw the thumbs up coming out the windows, and when we got to the foot of the ladder, I asked him, I said, you saw those thumbs up, didn't you? And he said, I did. And I said, these troops are trained, they're ready, and they'll do what you need them to. And he said, I know. And he bounced up the stairs. They taxied out. As Air Force One lifted off, two F-16s pulled up on his wing, and I said, now we're starting to get our act together. Mm. We're starting to get organized, but... again, there was a lot of confusion that day.
I read a story that I don't know whether it was when he was coming off Air Force One to your command center or going back. The young airman driving the van was driving pretty aggressively. He wanted to make sure to get the president there. And the story I heard is the president said, slow down, son. There's no terrorists here on this base.
That's exactly right. And he was as down to earth as could be, the kind of guy you want to play golf with, but obviously... it was a serious day, but you can still tell the personality and the character of an individual.
Now, Tom, one of the things that I really appreciated about your comments to the Distinguished Flying Cross Society, you talked about some of the things that that happened to you or that you participated in post 9/11, first pitches, other sorts of things. Tell our listeners, because that's very impactful.
If you have to fast forward from 9/11 to April 15th, 2002, tax day, it was the 50th anniversary of the B-52. We just passed last week that 65th anniversary of the B-52, and it's going to be around till 2040. So that aircraft is a truck, and it's just going to keep going and going.
So 65 years, that's been flying.
That's been flying, and, it was the anniversary, and they said they needed someone to go to New York City, be on Fox News, go to Ground Zero, close the stock market, and throw out the first pitch at the Mets-Braves game. And, of course, you know what I worried about the most was the pitch of the Mets-Braves game. But I drilled a kid next door, and he kept saying, can I go in? I said, no, stay right there. I measured off 60 feet, 6 inches in practice. And I swore to myself I'd wildly throw the pitch over the catcher before I dribble it across the plate.
Mm-hmm.
We started off in the morning at Fox News, and I went to the green room, got makeup on, which I left on all day because it made me look much better. we went on, and the interviewer, unlike a professional like you, I don't think he did his homework. I leave his name out, but he said, so, General Keck, the 50th anniversary of the B-52. How old is the B-52?
Oops.
I was thinking to myself, I'm on national TV, and I've got a trick question on my hand, but the public affairs guys train you to answer, give your answer regardless of what the question is. But we finished Fox. We headed to Ground Zero, and that was where one of the more significant incidents happened. We went to Ground Zero at the time was about 10 football fields, 8 stories deep. And at the bottom of the Ground Zero were people working through material. A lot of first responders were at the bottom of the hole there, or Ground Zero. And they said, do you want to go in the pit? And I said, absolutely. And we went down, and there were 3 retired firefighters with orange hats on and orange vests. And they had a 1,000-yard stare, every one of them. They were just looking for parts because the next statement stunned me. They said, General Keck, these 3 firefighters lost sons on 9/11.
Mm.
And I was speechless, but fortunately I had two captains with me. Bugs and Breeze were their call signs. They, upon hearing that, reached in their flight suit pocket and pulled out an arming lanyard for JDAMs, mm-hmm. or a number of arming lanyards, and they gave them to the firefighters and everyone working down in the proximity. And they explained that they were attached to 2,000-pound JDAMs and just released over Afghanistan. And it turned out these guys came to life and ran to the truck and got me a piece of glass that they'd etched with 9/11 on it. And some kind of retribution or some kind of response made them change their day, and I'm sure changed their week and month for the year.
Now, just for our listeners who are civilians don't understand that, the lanyard, that's pretty much the last thing one pulls out of the nose of the bomb before it's, I mean, then it's really live at that point, right?
As the weapon separates, it is one of the checks, safety checks, but the lanyard stays in the aircraft.
Now, I assume at that point you're all in uniform, so they knew.
They knew, and they sincerely appreciated it, but it was one of the more touching moments I've ever had. The next thing was closing the stock market, and I'll tell you, the world has changed. After I closed the market, we went down on the floor, and just the uniforms had all the employees with tears in their eyes, shaking mm-hmm. hands with them. So that was significant. But again, the thing I worried about most was that first pitch.
Now, was it a strike, Tom?
Well,
I'll be honest, your wife's here. Was it a strike?
It was a strike. And
okay.
They put on the monitor 83 miles an hour, and I thanked the guy later because it was more like 17 miles an hour.
Well, but that would have confused a batter. They would have been waiting for days for the pitch to even get to the plate.
Little change-up's a good thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live in the studio by Lieutenant General Tom Keck, United States Air Force retired. We're talking about 9/11 and his experiences. Very, very powerful show. We've got a little bit of time. If you want to chat with General Keck, give us a call, 520-751-1041. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. I tell you, I've had a lot of great guests on the show, and I enjoy each and every one of them. This conversation today for me has been very, very powerful and really strikes to the heart of why we do this show. I'm a civilian who never had to serve in the military, because there's men like Tom Keck and women out there as well who do the job for us so that we can rest well at night. Tom, we're talking about a year after the 9/11 attacks. You're making the rounds in New York. Obviously pretty somber. And let me back up. So because it was the 50th anniversary of the B-52, was that your 800 hours of combat in Vietnam, was that in B-52s?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so did they select you because of that, or because you commanded the B-52 forces, or a little bit of both, or did no one ever tell you?
Air Force Commander was the primary reason.
Okay.
And just a quick footnote on the pitch. Miss Universe was singing the national anthem, and we walked out. Bobby Cox, before I walked out, had said, when they said the general's going to throw out the first pitch, looked at me and said, General, pitch from the grass. You'll fall on your fanny if you pitch from the mound. So I was changing my game plan, but what happened was, as I was walking out, I'm thinking grass, mound, as I'm walking. They said, and the first pitch tonight is thrown by Lieutenant General Keck, 8th Air Force Commander, in commemoration of the first flight of the B-52. And there was mild golf clap that went on, and then, but I had Bugs and Breeze on either side of me, and I had them walk out with me. And with General Keck are Bugs and Breeze, who just returned from combat over the skies of Afghanistan. And when they did that, the stadium went crazy. And I said, this is easy. I'm going to pitch from the mound, which I did. And like I said, it was a slow pitch, but it was a strike.
I tell you, Tom, in my previous life, I did a lot of military, well, a lot of work for some of the minor league teams in the spring training. And a first pitch, it's a lot of things could go wrong, so good on you.
A lot of pressure. Bobby Valentine ducked down, kneeled down, and he was suddenly a dot way down there. Nelson Doubleday, Abner Doubleday's great-great-grandson, invited us up to his box. I said, I got 12 guys with me. He said, bring them. And he said, would you like to go down to the field? And we went down behind home plate. And Mike Piazza was on deck, I remember clearly. And normally when you're on deck, the players don't look at the crowd. They're focused on the pitcher and what he's delivering. And he turned around and saw us in uniform, and he went down and shook everybody's hand. My assistant at the time was there, and he was a big fan from New England of the New York Mets. And he said, "Mike, hit it over right field fence." And it was kind of a Babe Ruth moment. Piazza screwed up. He hit it over the left field fence, but it was a home run, and it started a rally, and we ended up they ended up winning. I was afraid they were going to invite me back every week to throw out the first pitch because they did rally.
You know, baseball players are a superstitious lot, so I wouldn't. I think you were reasonable in your question there.
My last footnote on that trip was I had a bodyguard who looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger with a blonde flat top. He'd won the New York Congressional Medal for some things he did against some druggies. But on 9/11, his partner was at the bottom of the tower, and he started telling me about tying a rope around his waist and going in looking for him in the remains of the tower. And that's kind of a brotherhood thing and band of brothers and sisters that is the same ideal that the U.S. military has today.
Wow. Yeah, I tell you, well, there's nothing to say about that, Tom. Thank you so much for sharing that. It's been, you and I were talking off the air, it's been 16 years now, give or take. What about, it did change, and, you know, my day job, I'm involved in a lot in politics, and 9/11 changed our lives here in the United States significantly. And it hasn't stopped. We've been in a shooting war. Our Air Force personnel have been in a shooting war now for decades at some point or another in the globe, and it doesn't look like it's going to slow down anytime soon. What, from your perspective as a military leader, the threats and living under this, you know, World War II started, we finished it, big boom, we went on with our lives. How, from your perspective, Tom, how are things different?
Well, this one hasn't gone away. As you mentioned, 9/11 motivated a lot of young men and women to join the military today. Those who don't remember the event still are extremely aware of the world situation. And even if they don't remember, they're joining for the right reason. I find it amazing the youth today are different than we were. And I'm sure we were different than the World War II veterans.
Mm-hmm.
But their ideals and their legacy is the same. And they know what to do when they're under pressure. Granted, they're on iPhones and iPads now and game boxes. But they still deliver the mission because they know how important it is to the United States.
You know, I mentioned, Tom, that I never have to serve in the military. My brother was OSI. He was in the first Gulf War and a lot of other places he still can't talk about. But I spend a lot of time at the base. I do a lot of stuff to support the military. And it's not unusual that sometimes folks will ask me, well, you know, thanks for being here. Thanks for taking the time to do this. But I got to tell you, as a business person, involved in politics and sales and stuff, where some, you know, you have a lot of rough days. Going out there to the base and meeting the men and women that serve our nation, it recharges me. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be able to do that, to just go out to the base and sit and watch and listen, because I echo your sentiments. If I start to have doubts about this next generation or what's happening, and then I go out there and spend an hour or two with these young men and women, It recharges my tanks, and it inspires me, and it makes me feel so much better about the potential that our country still has.
I agree, and if you look back at that legacy, it was statistically impossible during World War II to finish 25 missions in 8th Air Force.
Mm.
You had a 60% chance of making it through each day as you went to work. Now, it's not like that today, but there are some in harm's way areas that are just as dangerous. But the kids today, kids, young men and women, know what they have to do, and they do it. Now, I will put a plug in right now. They've been reduced significantly, and the ops tempo, as you mentioned earlier, is it's tough on the individual, it's tough on the family, And we got to at least provide them with the right equipment and provide them with the right numbers so they can keep the temple going.
I agree. I mentioned before that the three-star general who spoke at the retirement ceremony, we are in uncharted territory here, and I do have concerns about, because, you know, we've talked about it before, when a warrior deploys, the entire family deploys, and the impacts of war on the human psyche, I don't think have really changed. I mean, the weapons have changed, but the idea and the impact on the human psyche hasn't changed over those years. And what are we, I think sometimes we rely too much on technology and science, and I'm very concerned about what we're doing to protect those living weapons, if you will. I mean, you know, fancy missiles and stuff is great, but the real asset we have, or any military has, are its good personnel, and we need to keep them sharp.
Well, we talked about the Blackbird earlier, and it was replaced by satellites, and things are just done differently today. But it's just as dangerous, and the men and women know that, but that's what they signed up for, and that's the dedication that they promised. And they're doing the job, but we got to provide them with the right support for not just equipment, but numbers of people.
We've got about 4 minutes left, Tom. What would be, having witnessed this and certainly not only participated but lived through such momentous part of our history, our military history, what would be your recommendations or your thoughts for some of these young people out there that are just considering going in? I mean, for example, you, what, why Air Force?
Well, I was an easy case. My dad never said, I want you to join the Air Force, because he was in the Air Force. And he knew I'd do the opposite. So he just would take me out when there was large launches,
mm-hmm.
and would motivate me that way. I do want to mention one point, though, as far as we're talking about the men and women today in the service. It's extremely important that they know that they've got America behind them, and the civilians that support, for instance, Davis-Monthan here, the DM-50 group, and others, definitely make a difference and show the men and women that America's behind them, and nothing can replace that as far as making a lethal force.
No question, and I'm glad at the top of the show you mentioned the Guard and Reservists as well. I mean, our citizen airmen and sailors and Marines and soldiers and Coasties, they're bearing much more of the burden of defending our nation now than they were even 20 years ago. It's a whole different Guard and Reserve. It's not our grandfather's Guard and Reserve, and they're out there doing the job as well. The 162nd, if I'm not mistaken, Tom, that's the largest fighter wing in the Air National Guard right here in Tucson.
And they've got a significant training mission internationally out there at the 162nd. I would say they do carry on, and it was supposed to be transparent, or the intent was to make it transparent whether they were Guard, Reserve, or active duty, and that is pretty much happened right now. Everybody's fighting alongside, they've got the same equipment, and it makes a big difference in your effectiveness.
Well, you mentioned it in your story about 9/11, those A-10s that you needed some help right away, you called the reserve base and he sent you some aircraft with the pilots ready to go.
And they would have made a difference. As you mentioned, that A-10 was built around a gun, and they may have trouble catching the airliner, but they could do a number on it if they had to.
Yeah, and I'm glad that I'm glad you and some of our pilots out there never had to make that decision.
Amen.
And pull that trigger. Well, Tom, thank you so much for your time here. I love I tell you, for me, you know, throwing out a first pitch is probably pretty cool. I would much rather attend a luncheon of the Friday pilots. What an august and interesting group.
You're invited anytime, Ben.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Folks, you can find their book, The Friday Pilots. You can find it on Amazon. It's a collection of stories of various pilots serving through various wars, including we have got a picture of them up here. We got an astronaut, a part of that group. Now, Tom, I don't recall, do you have a chapter in the book?
I joined the Friday Pilots, and it was like joining a Super Bowl team after they won the Super Bowl. But I will tell you that the book, $5 of it goes to the Fisher House, which takes care of families when people are in trouble in the VA. So I highly encourage you to look for that book.
There we go. We're talking Friday Pilots Part 2, just so we can get your stories in there. Tom Keck, thank you for your service, and thanks for joining us here on American Warrior today.
My pleasure, and thanks for doing what you're doing for the U.S. military.
definitely my honor and pleasure. Folks, check us out, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher.com. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.